Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Today's program was brought to you by Whole Foods Market. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Well, hello. Welcome to Chef's Story. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton coming to you live from Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And this is the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. And Chef's Story is brought to you every Wednesday at noon live. And today I'm sitting here with a very lively chef. And if he's not a household name to you now, he will be. I'm sitting here with Dan Kluger of ABC Kitchen. And why I say maybe some people don't know you, Dan, is because I understand over 200 countries tune in to Heritage Radio Network and over a million listeners.
Excellent.
So there could be a few people that might not have heard of you because you're so young. I can't believe all the accolades that have piled up. If ABC Kitchen, of course, is here in Manhattan, and that... the New York Times is given it stars, but it was named the best new restaurant in December 2010 by New York Magazine. Dan Kluger was named Chef of the Year in 2011 by Time Out New York. The James Beard Foundation, of course, he racked one of those up as best new restaurant in 2011. And in 2012, he was picked as one of the best new chefs by Food & Wine Magazine. He's extraordinary. So you've got to go to ABC Kitchen, but we're gonna delve into it. And hopefully after this program, you're going to just call up. And if you can't get a reservation, just drop my name. tell him Dan sent you. Anyway, so Dan, where did you grow up?
I grew up on the Upper West Side, New York City.
Oh, you're a New York City boy. How does a kid grow up on the Upper West Side? I mean, what did you didn't have a backyard or
we didn't have a backyard, but we lived in a large complex, so we actually had there's like four or five buildings, and so we had a huge playground that you know was gated off, and it was basically for the tenants. So, in a lot of respects, I grew up in this small little community within a huge community of the Upper West Side.
So, what were your food experiences on the? You know, Upper West Side's full of great little ethnic restaurants, good restaurants. What does a kid eat on the Upper West Side?
Pizza and Chinese food.
Oh, good pizza, I hope.
Yeah, you know, I grew up. In a family where we certainly ate a lot, we cooked a lot. We weren't necessarily, foodies as you hear all the time today. Mm-hmm. We weren't going out to eat a lot, but cooking and sitting around at the table was a big part of growing up and childhood.
Did you cook when you were a kid?
A little bit. I mean, nothing that gave me an inkling that this is what I would do with my life. But, I enjoyed baking or sort of being in the kitchen with my parents and doing something.
Okay, so you weren't this child protege and with your grandmother's, kitchen. No. So tell me, so when did this food bug bite you? How did it happen? Was it by chance?
It was totally by chance.
Really?
I went to Syracuse, and I thought I was going to do physical therapy or something along the lines
Syracuse
of that.
Syracuse University.
University, yeah. And basically, in this roundabout way, I got into some food studies and some nutrition, and that led to some restaurant management classes, and I was scared to death of the professors. And I
felt Wait. So you went into food studies. What year was this?
92.
92. So what did you think you were going to study? Was it anthropological? Was it political? What made you attracted to food studies?
Basically, I was planning to do graduate program for physical therapy. So in order to get there, I needed a degree that would give me anatomy and physiology, some nutrition, some biology, things like that. And so that's why I kind of started in this world of nutrition and food studies. And that was combined at that point in time with restaurant management classes and food service classes. And it was not a culinary school by any means, but you know, there was enough there that somebody walking out of that school with a degree in you know, food service management knew a little bit about what went on in a kitchen. And I just kind of caught this bug. I was kind of interested in it. I thought it was enticing, not from a cooking perspective, but from this restaurant perspective. And again, sort of in a roundabout way, I met Danny Meyer.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, well, that's amazing. And we're interested in the food, and you're such a killer cook. You really are. Alain Seyac was one of the deans at the International Culinary Center. You're his favorite restaurant at the moment, your food. You're just like hitting it out of the park. Anyway, so how did you meet Danny Meyer?
So there was this amazing guy, Leon Jeanette. His children went to Syracuse. He created an auditorium and a lecture series after his first wife had passed away. And he brought up everybody from Danny Meyer to Charlie Palmer to David Boulay to Tommy Hilfiger.
Wow, I wouldn't put all those people.
It was basically retail and food.
Oh, it was retail and food, okay.
And just strangely enough, I was talking to Tommy Hilfiger last night. He was in with a friend of mine from J. Crew. Mm. And I said, you know, hey, I met you back in the day with Leon Jeanette. My friend was like, Leon Jeanette worked for me. This was Mickey Drexler from J. Crew. He's like,
oh my God.
Leon worked for me years ago. And so they knew each other really well. And so I basically became very close with Leon. And Leon introduced me to Danny when he came up and gave me the opportunity to kind of sit and talk to him. And I did an internship in, I think, 94 or 95 with Danny. And it was mainly in the front of the house.
Where? Which
at Union Square Cafe.
Oh, Union Square.
And it was, you know, eye-opening. I'd never seen anything like this. I'd never experienced anything like this.
What do you mean eye-opening? I mean, you've eaten in restaurants. You were studying restaurant management. I think people out there don't understand the real world. So what was eye-opening about it for you?
I think, again, I didn't grow up going out to eat a lot. I think probably by the time that I had stepped into Union Square Cafe on my first day, we had probably, as a family, gone out maybe a dozen times to something other than Chinese food or, you know, of that nature. And through college, I went a few meals here and there. But I'd never really seen this high level of execution of food and service. And so to be in a place like Union Square that was incredibly busy with these amazing people working there. I mean, some of my dearest friends are through that experience.
But what's the secret sauce? Everybody's saying, what's Danny's secret sauce? Can you shed it here? Come on, share.
You know, I don't think there's a secret sauce to share as much as this was at a time when Danny was in the restaurant every day. Hmm. Paul Bowles Bevan, who is his managing partner and partner today, was in the restaurant every single day. And, you know, there really was a strong effort to create this family environment without it ever being forced. It was just there. It didn't need to be written in a manual. It was just there.
Caring.
And it was a lot about caring. And I mean, to this day, I still think there's a big part of hiring the right people. And at that point in time, with, you know, one restaurant, maybe two at that point, hiring the right people was a lot easier than I think it is today for anybody. I think today we feel very overwhelmed with hiring. I mean, it's the biggest crutch of our industry.
Mm. How many people work for you?
I have 45 in the kitchen, and I think we have about 150, 160 in the front of the house.
Not
at one time.
Okay, yeah. But how many covers do you do a day?
We do about 800 during the week and about 900 to 1,000 on the weekends.
Day.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's a busy restaurant.
One doesn't get that, you know, when one doesn't realize. But we'll get down to the restaurant a little down the road. So you met Danny, you work in front of house. How did you wind up in the kitchen?
So basically, after I graduated from college, I went back to work at Union Square. And it really was kind of supposed to be part-time. It was they needed a little bit of help. They were short a host. We had been talking, and I said, sure, I'll help out. And I was enjoying being in the front of the house. I always kind of thought, at that point in time, I was thinking, at some point I'm going to own a restaurant. this is great. Any experience is going to be great. And you know what? If I could get a little time in the kitchen just to see what's going on, that'll help too. So I started spending my days off in the kitchen just to see what life was like. And I mean, again, you talk about a busy restaurant and some little kid standing in the corner straight out of college. Like it was eye opening. I didn't speak a word of Spanish. I didn't know what was going on around me. And you know, I started as a cook. They offered me a job as a cook, and I was a prep cook. And I was peeling potatoes and cutting and frying calamari. And again, the prep crew at that point in time were pretty much all Spanish-speaking. So it was really sort of culture shock. And as hard as that was, it kind of like the bug was there. Just was exciting to go back to work each day.
Was it tactile? Was it sensory in your mouth, taste-wise? Had you tasted food? Of course, you ate the food there, but did it make you look at food a different way? Did it make you taste food a different way? Without a doubt,
all of those. I mean, again, you know, I grew up working in a bakery on the summers, and so being in food service wasn't completely new, but being in a restaurant at that point in time, there were, you know, probably 500 covers a day, 600 covers a day. So to see cases and cases of potatoes and to peel cases and cases of potatoes and things like that was all of a sudden like boring, but at the same time like a rush. It was kind of interesting. And so then to start tasting food and you know, Michael Romano's palate was amazing. And this,
he was the head chef then.
He was. And, you know, this real Italian American cooking, you know, there's some Asian influence and stuff, but all of a sudden I was experiencing things that were really new to me.
Mm-hmm. Like what? Do you remember?
Just, I mean, any of the Italian things I hadn't, I think I grew up and, you know, the most Italian I knew was like meatballs and spaghetti.
Yeah.
And so all of a sudden, you know, I start hearing them talk about Puglia and, you know, all sorts of other regions. It's like, what is he talking about? And so to go home and start reading and learning about these things on my own time was really exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And that really just kind of...
So how long were you in his kitchen?
I was there for about 3 years.
So they're famous for going to the Union Square Market. Mm-hmm. And so would you do that in the morning and see what happened? Did you ever go on those trips with him?
I never went on those trips, but I think that's what started the sort of local food bug for me.
Mm-hmm.
Was I remember talking to him one day and at that point in time, actually, I was working as a host. And so I would go every morning to get the specials from him and writing down the specials. And he says, ramps. I said, what are ramps? And he tells me. And then there's something else in there. I don't know if it's fiddlehead ferns or something. I was like, what's that? And so then all of a sudden, I was like, what? You know, these are things that I've never heard of. This is really interesting. Mm. So from that point on, I started walking through the market every day that it was open. And I started to see these things, and I started to, you know, cook on my days off with these things.
Mm. But then you went, it's like you went to the Danny Meyer School of Alumni Chefs. you worked for Colicchio, you worked for Michael Anthony, I think. So you worked with Floyd.
So I worked for Floyd.
Cardoz. Who'd you work for first, Colicchio or?
No, Floyd.
So tell me what happened. That's going to Indian spices. What? Why did you go there? You know, how?
He was working at a Union Square Cafe probably for about a year and a half while they were working on opening Tabla. And you know, he's doing all of his recipe development and just kind of being part of the kitchen, getting involved in the Danny environment, so to speak. And he and I hit it off, and when he was ready to open Tabla, he said, you know, come work for me. And at that point in time, I had done a full 3 years at Union Square, so it was definitely a good time to move on. And so I started with Floyd as a line cook and worked my way up, and I was there for 7 years, and I was his chef de cuisine by the time I left.
Wow, because that's a very definitive style, Indian, but very personal to Floyd. How much of it was Floyd? You're the chef de cuisine, and you have to have the passion for the food and the taste. How did you work and collaborate with Floyd on that?
I think after spending, I don't know, a good 3-4 years, I never necessarily picked up the overall culture because there's so much culture there.
Mm-hmm.
But I picked up this flavor profile. Mm-hmm. I picked up the cooking techniques, which, you know, I think he talks about today, learning from Greg Kuntz and that development of using those techniques. And I feel like today those are techniques I use, you know, no matter what I'm doing. And it was just a matter of applying spices or not applying spices. So I think I started to pick up the flavor profile. I enjoyed the spices. I enjoyed the food that he produced. And so from there, I was able to start to do my own adaptations and start to put things on the menu. And then the other sort of inspiration for a lot of the food for me that I presented to him was his wife and his mother. We would start talking. I'd go to their house, you know, for a picnic, or she'd be in the restaurant, or he'd just come in one day. He's like, "Oh, my mom made this the other night. You know, she's in town and she made this doll." I'm like, "That sounds pretty good." So I'd like take some notes and I go look something up, and you know, an hour later I'd put something in front of him. He's like, "Yeah, almost as good as mom's." And, you know, from there, a lot of things came into play as well.
A lot of things. Okay, well, we're going to have to take a break right now, but we're going to come back, and I'm going to follow up on that technique and spices. So.
Okay.
Foods Market, we believe in healthy snacking, eating our veggies, and supporting local. Check out Brad's Raw Chips, a local producer that created irresistible chips after their namesake's successful weight loss with a raw lifestyle. Their chips are gluten-free, nutrient-packed, and so good that you'll think you're indulging. For more information, visit bradsrawchips.com.
Well, welcome back. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton on heritageradionetwork.org. And this is Chef Story. And I'm talking to the dynamic, interesting Dan Kluger, chef from ABC Kitchen in New York City. And we just kind of did a memory lane talking about his past. And he was talking when he was working with Floyd Cardoz at Tabla, that he was using some techniques and learning techniques there and being turned on to spices that he hadn't experienced before. Dan, I want to ask you something about techniques. I think a lot of people, they cook from recipes and, you know, they know how to, you know, saute or, you know, grill or something like that. But how important is technique to you? When you said you learned these techniques, well, you were already an accomplished cook for 4 years. What more could you have learned? What is technique?
I mean, there's a lot of different parts of that, you know, word technique in terms of cooking. And I think part of them is, you know, how to braise, how to roast, how to saute, you know, how to poach, and all of those things. I think as you grow as a cook, as a chef, you become better at, you master, you become more fluent, so to speak, and you essentially create a better product. I mean, you think about the difference between a home cook reading a recipe and a professional chef doing the same recipe. They have the same ingredients, they have the same information. It's maybe a little bit of technique, like knowing when something's done, you know, using all your senses. I mean, I remember working at Tabla in the beginning and learning just different ways of making stocks and braises, and it was such a sensory thing because the way the kitchen was set up, it was fairly large, and as a meat cook, I would have four or five projects going at once, and I had to use all of my senses. One was listening to the meat searing, smelling the bones roasting, and basically running around the kitchen from one end to another, just using those two senses alone, knowing, okay, I can hear it starting to dry up. It's almost ready to be flipped. The bones smell like they're almost there, going and checking them, hearing the way they're sizzling, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, I think that's part of the technique. And then I think, you know, technique also for me is somewhat the cooking style. And you know, when I met Jean-Georges and I first did the tasting for him, and then when, you know, I basically came on board, I felt like it was a very good matchup technique-wise, and I use that word more in terms of flavor profiles. We're very similar in terms of sweet, sour, spicy, salty, crunchy, you know, textures. That was something I got a lot from Floyd in terms of these balance of textures and flavors, and you know, making somebody eat something that's a little bit salty and then balancing it out with something that's a little sweet, and then all of a sudden they get a little acid. And our food today, I mean, everybody talks about the food at ABC and how much they like it, and I think even for people who don't love chilies, all of a sudden they're eating something and they get this little pop of spice, and then, you know, it's cooled down with like some herbs like mint, and then they get a little acid, and the sort of ups and downs, the peaks and valleys in the food, I think create really exciting food. And so something so simple as, you know, roasted beets, or something so simple as corn, and the little twist that we do on them is what makes the food so exciting. And so I think, again, the techniques of how to apply these different balances of flavors, and then the cooking methods,
You opened a door there for me. You said, oh, when I had to sort of audition for Jean-Georges, tell me, what do you have to do to work for Jean-Georges, and how did that come about, and what was the audition like?
You know, I lucked out. They're really great in terms of having a real process when they interview and check out a chef, and they come in and the chef does one of his own recipes and one of their recipes, and luckily I didn't know all about that. I probably wouldn't have gone any further had I known, because I think that would have been so nerve-wracking. I met Jean-Georges in probably the most amazing way for my story and where we are. I was shopping at the market. I was working as a chef at a private club in Midtown called the Core Club. And it was something that Tom Colicchio had been consulting on. And so through Floyd, I met Tom. I started work for Tom. I spent a little time at Gramercy and Kraft, and then I opened this private club, and we were shopping at the farmer's market, and it was a small club, small volume, but I was shopping a lot. Like I went down, it was on 55th Street. I went with one of my guys. We spent a ton of money. We took two cabs, packed to the brim, back. So, you know, I wasn't just getting a small amount. It was kind of obvious that this was important to me. And I was at one of the farmer stands, Franca from Buried Treasures, and picking up a bunch of bags of stuff and moving them over towards the cab, and I think she must have said something, and he kind of looked at me, and then I looked at him, and I was like, you know, sort of flabbergasted, this is Jean-Georges. And you know, I'd eaten there a couple times, I'd met him, but not in this nature. And then I think she kind of introduced us, and we started talking, and he said, what are you up to? And I told him, and I know his business partner, Phil Suarez, through the Core Club, and I asked about him. And so we, you know, within a minute, we kind of developed a little rapport, and he said, you know, come talk to us. And the next day, I sent him an email, and we met up, I think, 2 days later, and within a couple of weeks, I was ready to go. And I lucked out, because I basically was able to get them to come in to lunch at the Core Club, and I did a huge tasting menu for them.
Mm. Oh, so that's how you auditioned.
I thought
you were in his home kitchen, you know?
No, that's why I say, like, I lucked out. Had I had to go to, you know, Jean-Georges, the flagship restaurant, and produce one of their recipes, I may not be here today. So I really lucked out. And you know, the great thing was I was able to do what I do in the setting that I was working in, and, you know, at that point in time,
home court advantage.
I had home court advantage for sure, and you know, I think that being a chef is more than just producing the food. I think it's the full picture of you know, helping with the overall experience. I think that's something that he's very much involved with as well. And so,
what do you mean by that?
I think it's how the food is delivered, what goes on in the front of the house, and I don't think it's a
Of house, back of house.
Yeah, I don't think there's an ego thing. Like, I need to be involved in everything. It's just I think it's important that the whole experience comes together. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, working with the front of the house staff and
well, talk about collaboration. You've worked with, you know, Floyd, and you were the chef de cuisine, which for people out there, that means you're the real operating chef, getting the food out every day and the plates. And then you work with Jean-Georges, and people might say, ABC Kitchen, oh, isn't that a Jean-Georges restaurant? But it's really a Dan Kluger restaurant. How do you work with these chefs and be the chef of the restaurant? Is it their ideas for a menu? Is it both of you? Do you collaborate? Whose touch is in the food? How does that work? Because you seem to be an incredibly collaborative chef, but once again, you've been singled out by all those publications I talked about at the top of the program for your excellence. How do you do it? How does that work?
You know, I think one thing is you know what you're signing up for. You know, the ego has to stay at home in that respect. I mean, when I worked for Floyd, I worked my way up. So to this day, he's still one of my best friends. So the collaboration in that respect was very easy. There was never an ego of like, well, you know, this is mine. I don't want to change it. You know, I would make something. I'd say, what do you think? And you know, there was either a great good to go or there was, you know, a slight adjustment for whatever reason. And I think that always made it better. So when I went to Jean-Georges, you know, I'd been working for about 4 or 5 years doing my own thing. And you know, again, it was a little bit of a step back of, you know, a collaboration, but I looked at it, and I still do, as the guy's incredibly successful. He's a successful restaurateur, successful chef, amazing palate, amazing ideas. So anything that I bring to him and that we tweak, it's got to be making it better. And so I learn from that, and I take away from that. And I think all of that, you know, has made me grow in terms of how I present food to him, how I you know, present food to myself, the things that I make for myself, and then you know, how I will eventually work in that scenario with somebody else when I have a chef cuisine.
So you know how to be a mentor.
I hope so. I hope so.
So along the way, we're gonna move on to your personal philosophies in a minute. But along the way, who were you say your top three influences were, and mentors, and what were the most important elements in shaping you as a chef? Maybe there weren't people, but what were the elements? Three elements that really shaped you as a chef.
I think Union Square Cafe as a whole, between Danny, Paul, and the whole crew there, that are, you know, still friends this day. I think that started me. That taught me this, you know, Danny enlightened hospitality thing. That again, it's not just being a chef. I think it's, you know, it's very easy to go into work and you know, be frustrated that something's not coming out right, or you know, sort of just think that this is just a scenario of people putting out food and serving it and we're done. There's much more than that. And you know, even at the hardest of times and the most frustrating of situations, I still care deeply about the people that work for me and I want to see them grow. The reality is it's a business and you know, things have to move on. But I really got a lot of, you know, caring for my coworkers, caring for the people that come in to eat. And I got that from my start at Union Square Cafe. I think Floyd Cardoz, without a doubt, and just my time at Tabla. I mean, Tabla, you know, unfortunately, is closed today, but it was always the little engine that could. It had this culture and soul that is sort of I've never seen before. I mean, the people that came through there, just an amazing group of people, and I think a lot of that came from Floyd and his leadership and the other people that were managers there. So that was a big part of shaping me in terms of, again, a manager and a chef. The food, the technique, the spices, the balance of flavors. Floyd was a big shopper at the farmer's market, or Tabla was, I'd say.
Can I just tell people that Floyd is going to be on May 30th?
I'm excited to tune into
that.
Yeah,
so you've given me a lot of you know, a lot of good stuff here to talk to him
about. I'll have to see if he says as nice things about me as I'm saying about him. But that you know, definitely helped shape me as a chef. And then I think doing this private club and being in a place where it was a very different clientele, but I was allowed to do the food that I wanted to do.
So, other than people, were there other things that self-discipline, you know, other things that shaped you that you think it takes? What's the stuff that a chef needs to be? What's the difference between a cook? I know a lot of chefs or cooks, let's say, in restaurants who say, I don't want to be a chef. It's too much responsibility. Mm-hmm. I don't even want to be a sous chef. It's too much responsibility. Yeah. What is the stuff that propels you to be a chef?
Again, I think there's, it's, you know, somewhat a personality thing. Like you, there's nothing better than being in the thick of it on a, you know, Thursday, Friday, Saturday night, whatever night it is, and, you know, really being busy, but being able to put up a piece of food and be like, wow, that looks good. That's perfectly cooked. That tastes right. I find that very exciting to this day. I find that exciting. I found it exciting when I first started. I'm, you know, working at Union Square and putting up a great bowl of pasta. It was like, wow, this is amazing. So you have to be excited by that for sure. And I think the self-discipline is a big part of it too. A lot of cooks come in and, you know, oh, when do I move up? When do I do? A lot of it comes down to you. people talk about culinary school. A lot of it comes down to you as the student. You can come in, you can just get, you know, your A or your B or whatever it is and be done. Same thing in college. I was a horrible student. And when I found what I liked, my self-discipline propelled me to being an A student. When I now decided that I wanted to cook, I spent every off minute that I had at Barnes & Noble's picking up books, starting to read, starting to learn more about food, just always applying myself in some form or another. And today, it's even easier. I mean, with the internet, it's nonstop. I mean, you just...
Yeah. So what inspires you to, how do you have time? I know you're married, you have kids, you know, you've got this 800 person a day, and you have to keep everybody happy. You're sort of the main force at the restaurant. What inspires you? How do you get in, you know, how do you keep yourself creative?
You know, I think in inspiration in terms of going to work and being a chef, I think that inspiration is one thing, and that's, somewhat a immediate gratitude of seeing somebody happy when they dine at ABC or when they eat at my house, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And then I think the creative and that part of it is really everything from, again, I mean, between social media and everything, there's in 5 minutes you can come up with 10 new ideas just from little flashes on the web of mm-hmm. some dish or, you know, looking in a magazine. So it's everywhere in terms of that. And mm-hmm. I think for me, it's very much locally based in terms of going through the farmer's market and picking up, you know, three or four ingredients and having this tactile thing where all of a sudden you're touching peaches and tomatoes and sunflower sprouts are in front of you, and all of a sudden, you know, that became a new dish last year. And I think, you know, to me, that's one of the most exciting things, and again, one of the most rewarding things. Like, you have to enjoy making a dish and then being able to put it out and look at it and say, like, this is right, this is what I want.
We're gonna break in a couple of minutes, and we're gonna go to you are probably one of the most exciting local sustainable green chefs working today, and I want to delve into that. But here's a quick question for ABC Kitchen. You're talking about being inspired by seeing the produce. I mean, you know, you're running a restaurant in a furniture store, and you know, it isn't ABC is just amazing. It's not your typical furniture store. Very funky, and it's an extraordinary room that you eat in. How much are you inspired by the decor? What does that do? I mean, how do you vision that? When they said to you, we're going to put you in a furniture store, what was your reaction, and what are the pros and cons of that?
You know, I think it wasn't like we had this concept and then we found the space. There was very much, you know, Phil Suarez had this space, and there was a concept that they wanted to do for a long time. And again, my meeting Jean-Georges at the farmer's market is really just kind of, it was kismet. It put me in a situation where he kind of one day said, I think this is the right project for you. But I think that, you know, the store and Paulette Cole, the owner of ABC Home, her vision, her passion, her excitement for sort of sustainable and green and you know, sort of saving the world.
Also, it was beyond, you know, just having, here I have a space in the store, but she really believed in the philosophy.
They're very much, you know, sort of, how do we make the world a better place? How do we live a little more sustainably?
And I want to remind people that New York Magazine called this the best new restaurant in New York City in 2010, and the James Beard Foundation called it the best new restaurant in 2011. So maybe people should just start considering these these other alternative paths. Okay, well, we're going to take another break. I'm speaking to Dan Kluger, the chef of ABC Kitchen, and we'll be right back.
Thank you.
Hi, welcome back. This is Chef's Story with Dorothy Cann Hamilton of the International Culinary Center in New York. It used to be the French Culinary Institute. We're on heritageradionetwork.org, and I am talking to the fascinating chef, Dan Kluger of ABC Kitchen in New York City. And we've been talking influences past, but Dan is probably one of the foremost chefs working today with sustainable local philosophy, but also very green philosophy, and down to lots of business decisions that they make in that restaurant. Dan, every restaurant now that, you know, wants to be taken seriously talks about we source locally, we work with farmers. What does that mean? Because I think that's really expensive. And unless you're doing a great business, the cost of that can put you under. What is the real cost of being local, sustainable, buying from farmers, and how hard is it to do properly?
I mean, it's without a doubt more expensive. I was talking to somebody the other day about onions. I think, you know, a bag of onions from a normal purveyor is, you know, let's say $20, and if you got it through the market, it's going to be like $60. So there's a huge increase.
So wait, so if you buy it like just from the distributor that mm-hmm. sells to restaurants, it's $20. But if you use the small farmer, it's $60.
It
so it's triple the cost. What about an organic egg? How is that different from a regular egg?
Again, I'd say about double to triple. It depends on things, lemons, limes, all these things. I mean,
so do you have to be an expensive restaurant to be local and organic? And how do you? Because I know that you are a good business chef as well as a chef. You're very responsible. How does this work?
You know, I think it's an overall model. I think, you know, one of the things is we are incredibly busy, which it doesn't necessarily correlate in this way that, you know, just because we're busy, we're able to do these things. But because we are busy, we're able to use up product. It never goes bad.
You're talking waste. So, yeah.
There's very little waste in that respect. And, you know, I think...
Because you buy volume, do you get a chip?
Not really.
No?
Not really. I mean, you know, the farmers, they can sell most of their produce at the farmer's market without us. So they don't really give a huge discount. You know, if you buy four crates of asparagus, you might make a small savings. But I think in general, it's a more expensive model. I feel like the portions are fairly generous. We definitely made a mindset on our end, just in terms of a sort of healthier eating, to not do huge protein portions and to concentrate more on the vegetables. So we have proteins, but, you know, even a piece of fish is going to be a slightly smaller piece of fish than you might find in another restaurant, but more vegetables because we want to focus on the vegetables. So that's one part of it. And, you know, proteins are without a doubt expensive. Forget the whole.
So what's an average size? Is it in a restaurant, maybe 8 ounces for a piece of fish?
I'd say 6 to 7 ounces is probably a normal fish portion. Again, it depends on the restaurant.
Sure.
But I'd say at least 6 ounces on average. And we typically go about 4.5 to 5 ounces, depending on what it is. So,
and that's more than enough for a human being.
I had a piece of bass yesterday, and I feel like by the time I was done with all the vegetables I had a full meal, and I was as happy as can be. So,
And he's a big guy. I'm sitting here looking at him.
Not that big. So I think, you know, that's one part of it. You know, we've made a lot of other conscious decisions in terms of the paper we use and the inks we use and the candles and these sort of things. But, you know, I try not to. I get a little nervous when everybody starts talking about the green and the sustainable and all these things. I think we've made conscious decisions. There are a lot of other restaurants doing these things. Some are doing them even better. I think we just try and be conscious to our community. We try and be conscious to our environment.
Tell us what that means. I was really fascinated by, I did some reading about what levels you take this to in your kitchen and what kind of candles you buy and how much is recycled. Can you go into that a little bit?
We recycle everything. We compost everything. One of the things that we're working on now, which I think is really cool, which ABC Home has been working on developing, is the the waste oil that gets picked up. I mean, most restaurants do this.
So this is the oil that you would have fried in and
exactly.
stuff like that.
I mean, pretty much everybody does this. But
right.
one of the things that, again, we try and close the loop on certain things. And this is something we've done where the company that picks it up is now basically turning into biodiesel for the ABC Home trucks from one of their warehouses.
Oh.
So again, you know, the closed cycle, the closed loop is an exciting part of what we do. But again, I mean, you know, for me, I all the accolades, all the stuff, like it's great, but we just set out to create a restaurant with good food. I go in to cook each day.
Tell me your favorite dish of the week. I think people are out there going, this guy is fascinating. What's the food taste like? So tell us about a dish you're doing this week that you're inspired by, and what's the flavor profile? What's the technique profile?
It's funny, I can't think of anything right now.
Okay, so I do have a menu
you
here.
You have a menu.
I do, and I'm going to, if I can just leaf through my stuff. I think there's a carrot dish on here
yep.
that sounds fascinating. It's called Roast Carrot and Avocado Salad, Crunchy Seeds, Sour Cream, and Citrus. I want it right now. Tell me about that dish.
So this was one of the first dishes that... I remember doing Jean-Georges, and I think it was, again, very exciting because it has cumin, it has chilies, it has vinegar, it has the sweetness of the carrots. And I started to taste these things, and it just reminded me a little bit of tabla.
Mm.
And it was like, you know, sort of eye-opening in terms of, okay, this is going to be a really good match. Like, we're cooking a lot of the same things. So basically, it's a, you know, spice-rubbed carrot, so to speak, roasted, and then we have avocado. So you have creamy carrots, creamy avocado, and then we buy these sprouts from the farmer's market that are a little crunchy and different flavors in terms of radish sprouts. There's some bitterness, and then crunchy seeds like sunflower and sesame.
So it's sounding to me that it isn't just the seasoning, but the texture that mm-hmm. you're very involved with.
Mm-hmm.
So do you like crunchy? It sounds like crunchy. I'm a crunchy person.
I love crunchy. I love like soft and crunchy.
Right.
I like mixing the two together.
So when you're conceiving, is the texture, what pops first in your mind?
It always depends. We try and be very product driven. I try and go and find something that I like and start developing something based on that. And so, I mean, right now we're talking about strawberries coming in. So now we'll start looking at strawberries and what are we going to do with those? And I was, you know, playing with something the other day and things just kind of come along. There's a little bit of like pulling from memory, a little bit of pulling from things that I know go well together, something that, I just happen to like walk into the walk-in and literally like something was right in front of me and that became part of the dish. You know, it's...
Yeah, okay, so here's another thing. Oh, you're going to want to run there. Roast suckling pig. But get this. Plum smoked bacon marmalade with braised turnips. Tell me about the plum smoked bacon marmalade.
So that was something we were doing actually in the summer where I jokingly said to somebody that we don't do a lot of meat. We do a lot of vegetables. And so when we do meat, we go big. And and this is basically, we take a whole suckling pig. We cook it slowly. We pick it. We put it back together. And then we cut into small portions. And so you have really tender meat with a crispy piece of skin. And then I made this bacon marmalade with chilies and ginger and just bacon and sugar and vinegar. And at that point in time, plums were around. So we added in plums. And you had this like sort of sweet, sour, salty, smoky plum bacon marmalade, and that just goes
on top. Did
you have
the crunch of the bacon?
You have a little bit of crunch of the bacon. Then you have the crunch from the skin. You have the soft flesh, and then you have like little nuggets of bacon.
Oh, this is sounding dirty. You know what? There's another thing on here, and it's called still warm mozzarella. And so I'm going to get into how you make it still warm, and I think a lot of people can figure it out. But my brother took me to a place here in Brooklyn that makes its own mozzarella, and he said to me, it's really special. It's called Oh My God Mozzarella. And I said, it's called Oh My God Mozzarella. And, you know, the guy handed me the mozzarella, and it was warm. And I went, Oh My God. He goes, that's why we call it Oh My God Mozzarella. So you're the first menu I've seen Oh My God Mozzarella on. So tell me about the still warm mozzarella. How do you serve it up? And
so basically we wanted to do some of the mozzarella, and one day I decided to set out and try and make it from scratch, and we'd been playing with it on and off, and It just worked really well. And basically, we buy the milk from one of the upstate farms.
Oh, so it's special milk.
No, it's just, it's, I mean, you can do it with basically any milk.
But it's from a farm. Yeah. So it's really delicious.
It's good milk. And then we turn it into the curds ourselves, and then we stretch it and make the mozzarella right from the milk. So within, you know, 30, 40 minutes, you've taken a gallon of milk and you've made mozzarella, and we stretch it to order. So it's still warm, and we just do olive oil, salt, pepper, and that's really it.
Mm. So I read, you know, you were talking about olive oil maybe not being local. It's kind of hard in New York City to have local olive oil. What kind of, are you an Italian diehard with olive oil, or have, where else can we find olive oil in the world?
I'll tell you, I mean, I hate to do the shameless plug, but I think California Olive Ranch, which is a sustainably driven company right out of California, amazing olive oil. We tasted, when we were opening, we tasted, you know, four or five different kinds of olive oils, and two of theirs were our favorite. And
really?
So one is on the table and one we use for cooking. And I mean, there's tons of olive oil. And one of my friends brings me some from his family in Greece every so often. He'll bring me like a Fiji bottle filled with some olive oil. And it's amazing. But
you know, there is terroir for olive oil. You know, everybody can understand it with wine.
But
all of these places, they have different profiles. Okay, so let's get to the future. 10 years from now, what do you, you know, what do you want people saying about you?
Just that I cooked good food and I was a nice person.
Oh, that's, you know what? He is. And when I said big before, I didn't mean like, you know, he's muscular. You could see physical therapy here. You were, you know. So, but do you see, how do you see food evolving? How do you see your menu evolving? Maybe not in 10 years, in two. Let's make it.
You know, I again, for me, I want to continue doing what I'm doing with food. I think, again, you know, we make a very strong effort to shop locally. We still are going to use other things. You know, we're still going to use a cheese from Italy. We're still going to use an olive oil from California, or, you know, truffles from France or Italy. I mean, you can only do so much. The main thing is we want to create good, strong, flavorful food, no matter what cuisine we're doing. So I hope to explore other cuisines within the same style of shopping locally. I love being at the farmer's market and buying things. And I think, you know, over the next couple of years, we'll do more of that. I think food in general, you know, we'll probably see even more locally based food. I think it's you're seeing a lot more movements of people going and starting farms,
That's great.
Of finding new things. Mm-hmm. I met these two women out in Long Island in Amagansett, and they've started growing old varieties of wheat that used to be out in Long Island. And, you know, it's amazing to see somebody deciding now to go and start growing wheat. And
That is me. One last question before I leave, because, you know, as head of the French Culinary Institute, I know a lot of chefs, and we've grown for 30 years a lot of chefs. It's one of the toughest jobs in the world. It's like one of those jobs you have to love. And how do you maintain a family and be a chef and work those kinds of hours? I mean, it's a real challenge. Do you have something you can share, a secret you can share for us?
You know, again, I hope I don't set out to make friends every day, but I set out to be a good person.
Mm-hmm.
I set out for, you know, my staff to respect me and appreciate what I'm doing. They don't always have to agree.
Mm-hmm.
So I've worked hard to find good people, and I've had a great number of the kitchen team that have been with me for years. And so I think having that trust and having, you know, that knowledge that people really have your back when you're not there is a big part of it. I think there's a little bit of just, you know, remembering that this isn't brain surgery and that this isn't necessarily life or death. I mean, for some people it can be, in terms of you could really kill a business, but you know, things will get by without me. And so it's taken a while to figure out sometimes how to just not answer the phone or not deal with something. But again, I have an amazing group of people that I work with and that, you know, really help me get through each day. And so that's a big part of it. And, you know, luckily I have a wife and two kids that I think kind of understand that this is my career and this is what I've chosen. And, you know, especially for my wife, she now sees this as there's been some payoff. You know, I mean.
Well, I'll tell you, we've got to sign off now, but Dan Kluger is one hell of a chef. Get yourself over to ABC Kitchen. But he's also one nice guy. Thanks, Dan, for being here today.
Thanks for being part of it.
See you next week. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.